With news from Minnesota Public Radio, I'm Mike Mulcahy. Governor-elect Jesse Ventura is pushing for the incoming First Lady to get a salary, too. Ventura says his wife, Terry, has already virtually abandoned her horse-raising business because of the duties of First Lady. He says she should get paid $25,000 or so for all the work she'll be doing for the state. The governor's salary is more than $120,000 a year. The demolition work in downtown St. Cloud is complete, and crews are now clearing away the debris from the December 11th natural gas explosion. The owners of the four buildings destroyed by the blast are still deciding whether to rebuild. Stearns County officials are also eyeing the downtown property. The Minnesota Vikings will have wide receiver Jake Reed back in uniform when they host a playoff game a week from Sunday. Reed hasn't played since undergoing back surgery last month, but coaches say he's done well in practice this week, and Reed says he feels good. He gave credit to Matthew Hatchett, who filled in for him while he was injured. Reed said Hatchett gained valuable experience from the year.
You never know. Hatchett may have to step in there again, you know, so because it's going to be a very physical game. But Hatchett is ready. Hatchett ready to go, and, you know, I give all my respect and prop that. He's a good ball player. When you have a ball player like that, it make you want to get well fast.
The Vikings' opponent in their January 10th game depends on the outcome of this weekend's playoff games. Well, it's going to be a cold New Year's Eve. For this afternoon, there'll be some partial clearing around the state, highs from 10 below to around 10 above. Tonight, a chance for some light snow in the far southwest late tonight. Otherwise, lows around 25 below in the far north to near zero in the southwest. Right now, it's cloudy generally in the north, sunny in the south. St. Cloud has 3 above, Duluth 8 below, and the Twin Cities 4 above. That's news. I'm Mike Mulcahy.
Thank you, Mike. 6 minutes now past 11 o'clock. Programming and NPR is supported by Hazleton Foundation. For over 50 years, a national leader in adult alcohol and drug addiction recovery in Center City, Minnesota. 800-257-7800. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. 1998 has been a very busy year for news reporters. And today on Midday, before we let this year get away, we're going to look back at some of the major stories of 1998. Stories which will ultimately take us to the storm-ravaged communities of southern Minnesota, the picket lines at Twin Cities International, financially strapped farms of Minnesota family farmers, and some of the boardrooms of Minnesota tycoons. All of those stories and more are coming up this hour, and we hope you'll be able to travel along as we revisit the places and the people who made Minnesota headlines this year. Our tour begins, naturally enough, on the campaign trail. For the first time in 16 years, the governor's seat was up for grabs this year. When Governor Arne Carlson announced that he would not seek re-election, a large field of candidates stepped forward. First there were 10, then there were 3, and finally there was just one.
When I was in the Grand Day Parade, people were saying along that whole parade route, "Mayor, run for governor, run for governor." And I listened.
When people go to vote, there is a level of trust and familiarity that needs to be there in order for someone to really have the opportunity to govern well. I hope that the work that I've done for the last 16 years as Attorney General will be a foundation for that.
I want to find out if it's indeed true that you must be a professional politician to lead and govern a state, or can a citizen govern? If I fail, in my opinion, the American dream is now dead, and you must be a professional politician.
I believe in my bones, I believe in all my heart, that a society built on lasting values like family and faith, respect for the dignity of all life, unlimited democratic government is the best path to achieving the great human potential.
What Humphrey is going to be all involved about is education. Education and helping families right from the very, very beginning.
My property, take for example, has jumped an average of $460 a year for the last 4 years in a row, all while we've had a $4 billion surplus going on at the Capitol. Why do you think I'm running for governor?
Is a vote for Jesse Ventura a wasted protest vote?
Absolutely not, and I think that's pompous and arrogant to state that.
What do you think the chances are that Jesse might actually win?
I think Jesse's ceiling is probably around 25%, as was Ross Perot's in 1992.
I've been listening to the debates, and I really like Jesse and his ideas. I think he's in with the people, and I like that.
2 months ago, they told me I was 10% in their so-called polls. Now I'm up to almost 25% in a matter of a couple of weeks. My candidacy has wind in the sails. We're moving.
We are pumped. I mean, we are pumped. I mean, this is just so fun.
I drive over the road truck and was able to vote on an absentee ballot, and I've already cast my vote for Jesse.
We've received so many inquiries from the college students asking how to register, where they can vote, what the procedures are. I'm not sure what it's due to, but it's really nice and refreshing to see so many young people out.
60% of the vote is now in. Jesse Ventura with 37% of the ballots counted. Norm Coleman, the Republican, 34%. Skip Humphrey, 28%. He is the DFL candidate.
Jesse, 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 Jesse,
now it's 1998, and the American dream lives on in Minnesota as we shock the world.
That portrait of this year's campaign was produced by Minnesota Public Radio's Jim Bickle. Now, over the noon hour today, we're going to have much, much more on the campaign for governor. We'll take a closer look at Jesse Ventura's victory, and then we'll be talking with three folks who watched the entire campaign unfold. Ventura advisor Dean Barkley, Coleman advisor Cindy Brucato, and Humphrey advisor Eric Johnson. That's coming up over the noon hour, and of course we'll be opening the phone lines as well so you can participate. Right now, we're going to continue our look at some of the other big stories that headlined Minnesota news this year, and our next stop this hour is southern Minnesota. On Sunday, March 29th, a huge storm devastated more than 60 miles of south-central Minnesota. The storm virtually destroyed the small town of Comfrey. Then about 5:30, an F3 tornado carrying winds of up to 206 miles per hour roared through St. Peter. Two people were killed, one of them a boy who was just 6 years old. Minnesota Public Radio's Lynette Nyman was in St. Peter on March 29th when the tornado arrived. She's been following the recovery since.
As the warning sirens roared, most people ran to a basement, if they had one. A few of the brave, or maybe the foolish, ventured outside to watch. That was until the tornado blasted across the city of St. Peter. It was over in just a matter of moments. As people emerged, most were unsure what had happened. But it was evident everything had changed.
The width of it was, I would say, a mile to a mile and a half, because there was a farm off in the distance, and it was completely covered. The whole area was covered with the motion of this tornado.
Uprooted trees, downed power lines, shattered glass, and other debris covered the roads. Public safety workers spread out looking to help, dealing with problems strewn across the town. As darkness descended, hundreds of people wandered the streets looking for friends and family. Nearly all communications were out. Only a scattering of phones around the outer edges of town still worked. Cell phone systems were overloaded. With the darkness came the cold, which was to grip many people who were to be without heat and power for the coming week. Many, like Robbie Lynn and his family, had a lot less.
We lost two houses. One's right here and one's out in the country. We just moved out, not even completely moved out into the country yet, and that's totally gone. Trailer house, five sheds, houses, there's no house.
Business owners boarded up busted storefronts using plywood available at a local lumber yard on a take-now-pay-later basis. Bulldozers rumbled through the streets, pushing aside the storm's wreckage. Later in the night, the National Guard patrolled the town. With military trucks blocking off the streets, the cliché, "it's like a war zone," seemed to carry more weight. People desperately tried to come to terms with what had happened.
Well, it's a disaster. Total. Scary, but at least we're alive. That's the main thing.
We're standing here. We're vertical. And that's about it. The Lord is with us. He didn't do too very good a job on that church down there, though.
The town was designated a federal disaster area almost immediately. Federal emergency management officials set up at the state hospital along with the Red Cross and a shelter for displaced people. Soon, people needed to find something more permanent. Some turned to FEMA for help.
Okay, this is a list of some temporary housing units in the area that may be available and may fit your needs. So if you would like to look through that list.
Okay. Do you know if there's anything that's available right in St. Peter?
I didn't have a chance to even look through that thing.
Well, my only problem is that I am an EMT with the ambulance service, and I need to be in town.
Ann Mink helped tornado victims all night. Then she returned to her own badly damaged home. An hour later, people started knocking on Mink's door to help her pack up before she moved to another location.
I wandered around going, well, I don't know what to do. You know, usually when you're planning a move, you've packed up a good 5-6 weeks in advance, and I had no clue how to go about getting all this stuff out of this house and where it was going to go and whatever. And it was just amazing because I had all these people packing my belongings.
In the next few days, St. Peter was hit by a second force of nature, human nature, the desire to help out. Thousands of people poured into the city for the cleanup. The Salvation Army logged 20,000 volunteers within a 12-day period. There were so many, some were turned away. Gustavus Adolphus College alumni returned to their alma mater, which sustained around $50 million in damage. Kevin Miller of the class of 73 printed T-shirts with the slogan, Rebuilding a Greater Gustavus. He wore one while handing out gold and black lapel pins to volunteers. Miller was heading home from vacation when the storm hit the college.
In fact, I was sitting in the airport in Phoenix writing a letter to all of my former teachers here at Gustavus. Just inviting them to be a part of our 25th anniversary. And so it was about the same time that the tornado was going on. So as soon as we got back to Minneapolis, we heard about it. And I came down right away. So it was sort of like losing your own house. You know, it was because it's a part of me. And I think that's how all the Gustavus people feel.
The storm damaged many of St. Peter's historic treasures. Some, like the county courthouse and the Nicolet Hotel, are being restored. Then there are those like the old St. Peter Central School building. For the past 20 years, the Victorian-era structure housed the Arts and Heritage Center. Arnie Langshan, a lifelong St. Peter resident, was inside when the tornado smashed into the building.
It just got pitch black. And the thing I'd never read about in tornadoes was all electricity in that blackness. You know, it's just totally black out through the windows. And yet there were sparks flying every which way.
Langshan was just finishing a 3-year project, hand restoring the building's 86 windows.
Before the tornado, there were 3 left. The 84th one was on the desk. That's the one I was working on. So it was a bad timed tornado. I wish they had waited till I could have got a picture of the whole building, you know, but it didn't. And now it's hopeless. They can't restore that, I don't think.
Langshan was right. Demolition crews brought down the building's remnants in November. People watched in tears. For some, damage to St. Peter's last Catholic church was just as painful.
See the little Lamb of God? It was put into the high altar here a while back, so that's preserved.
The day after the storm, Father Harry Behan, pastor of the Church of St. Peter, surveyed the damage. Gaping holes bled daylight where once rose windows cast a warm glow on parishioners sitting in the pews below.
I had a service there Sunday at 4 o'clock. We had a reconciliation service and we had a full church. We finished at 10 to 5, and by 5:30, there was no church, as we know it. And so it was pretty devastating. I met a woman yesterday, and I was at Perkins in Mankato, and she said, oh, do you realize another 15 minutes, and I'd have been in heaven, because I just received absolution. So kind of a wry humor. People laugh during tragedies.
It's been 9 months since the St. Peter tornado. Many businesses have reopened. Competition for contractors remains fierce as homeowners rebuild. The city's total damage estimate stands between $250 and $300 million. And while St. Peter's residents are reconstructing their lives, they're trying to help Mother Nature too. Known for its tree-lined streets, St. Peter lost almost all of its foliage in the tornado. The city has replanted about 600 trees. Another 1,500 are slated for planting next spring. But there's still a lot more sky in St. Peter than there was before March 29, 1998. I'm Lynette Nyman, Minnesota Public Radio.
If you're just joining us on this last day of the year, we're reviewing some of the major stories of 1998. One of those major stories continued to unfold throughout the year, the farm story, if you will. Most farmers in our area are not going to look fondly on 1998. Main Street Radio's Mark Stile explains.
The seeds of the farm slump were as far-flung as the Asian financial crisis and as down-home as weather, overproduction, and disease. It was a year when Minnesota farmers took home their first billion-bushel corn crop, a record soybean harvest, and wagons full of red ink. The farm crisis of 1998 took hold first in the Red River Valley before rolling south, as cold and unforgiving as an Arctic front. It left in its wake farmers disillusioned at their role in the nation's food system.
You could just as well go and carry groceries at Hugo's and forget about the misery and headache, because that's all we're doing is beating our head against the wall out here. We employ 50% of the workforce in this country, feed the whole damn world, and we can't feed ourselves.
Steve Panic and his father went out of business last spring, unable to get an operating loan for their northwest Minnesota farm. Scores of wheat farmers in the Red River Valley went out of business this year, ruined by several consecutive years of bad weather and disease. The fungal blight bedeviling wheat growers has a name as repellent as its damage, scab. It's cost Northern Plains farmers an estimated $1 billion this decade.
And when you get forward, there's cover along at 200. 2 to get 2, 100. Over to get 100. Over to get 1, 1, 1 to get 1, 1 to get 1.
Scab was just one problem facing farmers. Take Red River Valley producer Randy Oz. Beset by drought, floods, and low grain prices, he's only had one profitable year in a decade. He sold out last spring.
Now that I'm getting out of it, I wouldn't get back in it right now for any amount, because I'm owing what I owe to the bank. By the time I clear up them guys, I'll be happy to be out of it. So all I know is every farmer I know that has quit farming hasn't regretted it.
By year's end, it was predicted 60% of northwest Minnesota farmers may not qualify for spring planting loans because they're in such poor financial shape. The economic tremors in the Red River Valley were quickly followed by apprehension in southern Minnesota, where crop prices fell faster and further than anyone had seen before.
The farm economy is pretty dismal right now with the current prices of both corn and soybeans.
Southern Minnesota farmer Brian Rumsdahl could only watch as the mountains of grain he and other farmers produced drove down prices.
If it truly is a supply and demand market and you're supplying more than what the demand is, it's financial suicide.
Adding to the problem was a decline in world demand for U.S. farm products. The biggest drop was Asia, where devalued currencies made American commodities unaffordable. University of Minnesota farm analyst Seaford Runge said the price drop left farmers virtually no profitable refuge.
Livestock prices and grain prices often run in ways that cause them to be offsetting. That is not true at the moment, and that we have fairly low prices, for example, in the hog market, combined with dropping prices in the corn market.
There was one exception, though, to the dreary price picture. Driven by strong butter and cheese demand, the price of raw milk soared to record levels during 1998. That was welcome news for an industry which had lost 3 farms a day for years. Still reeling from that disaster, Minnesota dairy farmers like Jerry Jennison welcomed the higher prices, but were cautious about how long they would last.
These are really bonus times, and I think you plan your business or you run your business that during these times, that's when you can make your improvements. You retire debt, but you don't plan on this kind of price forever. That's just poor business.
For most farmers, though, things got worse as the year went on. Many, like this farmer singer at a rally in Worthington, blame the government for their problems.
I remember back in 96 when we got the freedom to farm. The government said everything would be fine. No one should raise an alarm. But when I read the fine print, I knew we were in for a change. 'Cause when you take away the farm safety net, ain't nothing gonna be the same.
The Freedom to Farm legislation is supposed to end direct government farm subsidies and most of government's role in agriculture by 2002. It already has eliminated government control over how much corn and other grain farmers grow. With controls gone, farmers planted every available acre, contributing to the oversupply and falling prices. Farmers like Brian Rumsdahl like to call the legislation freedom to fail.
I don't have a very rosy picture of the future if this is kind of the precedence.
But even though low prices are driving farmers down to their bottom line, some defend freedom to farm. The legislation makes direct government payments to farmers through 2002 when the subsidies will stop. These payments are supposed to ease the transition of American agriculture from government control to the free market. Southern Minnesota farmer David Rowe said the legislation is painful but necessary.
We don't subsidize the hardware store owner or the small manufacturer. Why should we subsidize the person involved in production agriculture?
But even as freedom to farm is debated, steps are being taken to undercut the legislation. University of Minnesota farm analyst Seaford Runge predicts political realities will override political philosophy.
The fact is that if you have a substantial number of farmers in your congressional district, you see it properly as your job to respond to their concerns. To suggest that they would have nothing to do in these areas simply goes against the nature of the political beast.
Runge's prediction came true in October when Congress passed and the president signed a $7 billion emergency farm relief package. The money, along with record crops, will ease the impact of low prices but won't cure farmers' financial ills. And as the year ends, what may be the worst of 1998's farm problems is taking shape.
Right now I'm looking at 1,300 head of hogs that I need to sell in the next 4 weeks. I stand to lose $65,000 to $70,000 in the next 3 weeks.
At a meeting in Marshall, Randy Wurtsma of Rushmore described the flood of red ink his farm faces. Hog prices have collapsed. Calculated in constant dollars, they may be even lower than during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Faced with financial ruin, farmers like Dave Overman lash out, saying the hog oversupply is caused by the rapid growth of large-scale corporate farms.
I think them corporates are screwing us little farmers down the tubes. You should put moratorium on nationwide on them damn barns.
Yeah.
Put them out of business. They're putting us out of business.
There are calls for federal help to save pork producers. For many, though, any help will be too late. Escalating debt means they can't get a loan to save their business. As the new year begins, credit will be the major concern for all farmers. Ahead are weeks of negotiations and fine-tuning as they work to get the money they need for another year. This is Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio.
And this is Midday, coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. Today, to mark the end of the year, we're reviewing some of the big stories of the year gone by. And we'll continue our review in just a moment.
Coming up on Sound Money this week, information you need to get all the financial aid you qualify for from Calvin Cheney, author of Paying for College Without Going Broke. Hi, this is Bob Potter. We'll have answers to your questions about the federal forms, parental contributions, and more. Chris Farrell and Erica Whitlinger, too, so tune in and call in. Sound Money, Saturday morning at 10, again Sunday afternoon at 5 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
Just a reminder, over the noon hour today, as part of our year in review, we're going to spend the full hour talking about the campaign for governor, the campaign that ended with the surprising victory of Jesse Ventura. That's coming up over the noon hour today. Forecast for Minnesota, sunny in the north, partly cloudy in central Minnesota, cloudy in the south with some flurries. Highs today 10 below in the northeast to 10 above in the south. Twin Cities, gradual clearing through the afternoon with a high near 10 degrees above zero. Tomorrow, a New Year's Day, light snow across much of the state with highs from 5 below in the north, 15 above in the southwest. Twin Cities tomorrow, cloudy with some light snow. Well, our review of the top stories of the year continues now. Our review takes us next to the courtroom. Then we'll head to the picket line and then to the boardroom. First of all, the courtroom where Minnesota's tobacco trial will go down as one of the nation's biggest legal stories of the year. Twin Cities attorneys took on the seemingly unbeatable tobacco industry and ended up winning nearly $7 billion for the state and for Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota. Minnesota Public Radio's Elizabeth Stawicki reports.
Skeptics of Minnesota's case against the tobacco industry were plentiful in the early months of the case, with good reason. No one had won a major lawsuit against the tobacco companies. But Minnesota had something other lawsuits did not: internal documents that showed tobacco companies viewed themselves as drug companies. The drug was nicotine. Memos also showed the industry knew as early as the 1950s that smoking is addictive and causes cancer. But it publicly denied that, as this videotaped deposition shows of the late CEO of American Tobacco, Robert Hyman.
As far as you're concerned, is the Surgeon General simply wrong in concluding that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer?
I would use the term misguided.
Okay, if he's misguided, then I take it that your opinion is he's wrong.
I was simply trying to be polite about it.
Okay, but not being polite about it, in your opinion, he's wrong, correct?
Dead wrong.
Several CEOs testified similarly in Minnesota's tobacco trial, but the head of Liggett, Bennett LeBeau, broke ranks.
This is absurd to keep saying smoking doesn't cause health problems. Who in this world believes that? It's absurd to get up and say smoking's not addictive. It's ridiculous.
Tobacco's case in Minnesota suffered a major blow in April when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the industry had to turn over nearly 40,000 internal company memos that suggested tobacco lawyers, not scientists, controlled research on the health effects of smoking. Around the same time, support for a national settlement with the tobacco industry began unraveling. 2 days after the high court's ruling, the second largest tobacco company, R.J. Reynolds, pulled out of the proposed settlement. One tobacco critic, Northeastern University law professor Richard Daynard, saw a connection.
I think they just figured that things were sinking so fast when people got to see the documents that they handed over, there'd be absolutely no hope of getting anything better through Congress, and that they might as well just throw a long ball and hope it landed somewhere useful.
R.J. Reynolds' attorney Bob Weber disagreed. Weber blamed Congress for the breakdown.
I think the problem with what the resolution is at present is that they didn't talk to one important constituency, which was American smokers, and they didn't talk to the tobacco industry either. And I think they need to bring the tobacco industry and hear their viewpoint, and I think they need to hear from American smokers as well, who are going to be expected to carry this punitive tax burden.
4 months after Minnesota's trial began, the case came to a halt when a state settlement preempted what was supposed to be the last day of closing arguments. For Attorney General and then gubernatorial candidate Skip Humphrey, the settlement ended a four-year war.
The tobacco industry has surrendered, and they have surrendered on our terms.
The tobacco company said they settled because they could not get a fair trial in Minnesota. They often accused Judge Kenneth Fitzpatrick of bias. Philip Morris attorney Peter Blakely took particular issue with Fitzpatrick's ruling that banned the industry from raising the so-called death credit argument, the argument that smokers cost the health care system less because they die sooner.
That's one of the most absurd rulings in these cases I've ever seen anywhere, is that you will keep evidence away from a jury because it's horrendous. There is absolutely no question whatsoever that cigarette smokers do not cost more in health care than non-smokers. The net cost is less. But we're not allowed to present that evidence because we would be taking advantage of the fact that our product kills people. We're not talking about taking advantage, we're talking about what the facts are.
The industry agreed to pay the state $6.1 billion over the next 25 years. It also agreed to pay the state's attorney's fees and Blue Cross Blue Shield about a $500 million each. The companies also agreed to ban billboard advertising and disband their research council. The industry would also support Minnesota's tobacco document depository in Minneapolis. Stan Glantz, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and one of the industry's harshest critics, called the depository the state's most important contribution to future battles with tobacco companies.
The truth is a very powerful weapon, and the documents which are available in the Minnesota depository are ricocheting all over the world now and having tremendous, tremendous impact everywhere. And I think people still don't even appreciate what's there. And I think that was going to be the real legacy of the Minnesota case, is the truth.
Since the settlement, Judge Kenneth Fitzpatrick has retired and become a recluse. One former juror has declared bankruptcy. The law firm that represented the state, Robbins Kaplan Miller & Cerisi, donated $30 million of its attorney's fees to the Minneapolis Foundation to set up a permanent endowment for public health and K-12 education programs. Still, nearly $500 million in attorney's fees drew fire from many Republican leaders, including the governor. The state's lead attorney, Mike Cerisi, argued his firm earned those fees because Minnesota's case broke new ground and created a template for other lawsuits against the industry.
We did more than any other law firm in the country. We're the only law firm who represented a state by itself. Our documents were used throughout the world. All of our discovery was used throughout the world. We fought the national settlement in Congress. We protected Minnesota's rights in Congress. We had to hire lobbyists to do that. I'm sure the legislature would not have done that. Governor Carlson wanted us to take the $4 billion. He wanted the state to take $2 billion less than the state actually received and will receive.
Minnesota has set aside $202 million from its settlement for anti-smoking programs. But just like a lottery winner who discovers friends he never had, myriad interests have come forward wanting a piece of the remaining $6 billion. The legislature will sort through those requests in its next session. Last month, 46 other states settled their tobacco lawsuits. Under that settlement, tobacco companies will pay each state, on average, about half of what Minnesota received. But Minnesota's influence on the national tobacco scene appears mixed. While information coming out of the case appeared to derail last spring's national settlement, some critics say the industry got an even better deal last month. It's also unclear how much these multi-billion dollar settlements will damage the industry's financial bottom line. R.J. Reynolds has announced plans to lay off about 15% of its global workforce. But still, there's some question whether these settlements are really a tax on smokers in the end. Tobacco companies have raised their prices three times since May. Perhaps the most telling is on Wall Street. Since Minnesota's settlement, tobacco stocks have risen 42%. I'm Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio.
While the tobacco trial attorneys were dueling in the courtroom, the labor dispute at Northwest Airlines was playing out at the negotiating table, in the media, and ultimately on the picket line. And more trouble may lie ahead at Northwest. Two of Northwest's largest unions still don't have new contracts, and both are threatening to shut down Northwest in 1999 if their disputes aren't resolved. Minnesota Public Radio's Mark Zdechlik reports.
It was early spring when many Northwest customers began hearing about problems at the airline responsible for 8 of every 10 flights in and out of the Twin Cities airport. Thousands of Northwest employees who helped the airline avoid bankruptcy 5 years ago by agreeing to pay cuts were unable to negotiate new contracts with now profitable Northwest. Pockets of unhappy ground workers began disrupting the flight schedule. Ticket holders started running into increased delays and cancellations.
They said there was a lens cap on the wing that was cracked. So we sat there for an hour and they said, get off, we'll get back on here, get it fixed. They told us once the cap was down in the maintenance hangar, they're going to go get it. Then they told us it was en route in the air, flying in from somewhere else. And then they told us the flight was canceled.
According to government figures, 4 of every 10 Northwest flights in June were delayed. The airline posted a nearly 65% decrease in second quarter net income over the previous year. Management blamed disgruntled workers for costing $100 million in April, May, and in June. Although only small percentages of flights were affected, thousands of travelers were inconvenienced, and many began looking for options.
I am flying next week, and I am flying American, so
It is changing my travel plans from now on.
By the end of July, the International Association of Machinists, Northwest's largest union, which represents almost all of its ground workers, was voting down a contract offer. During the balloting, many machinists took Northwest management to task for failing to share record profits. The workers' last contract gave them 3 years of pay cuts. In early 1998, company insiders cashed in nearly $70 million of stock options. The employees were demanding their share.
It's our sweat that brought this company back and made everything work. They don't want to give us the money, but yet everybody else is getting, you know, raises and bonuses. And I haven't had a pay raise since 92.
The day after the machinists voted down their contract, Northwest's most powerful union, the Airline Pilots Association, was released from federally mediated contract talks with the airline. The countdown to the strike began. 30 days later, more than 6,000 pilots shut down Northwest Airlines.
I'm very disappointed to inform you that we have been unable to reach a tentative contract settlement with Northwest management. The deadline for our negotiations has now expired. I have instructed our strike committee to inform all Northwest pilots to withdraw their services immediately. No Northwest pilot will fly until further notice from me.
While thousands of travelers were inconvenienced by the strike, the Twin Cities Airport did not become overrun with thousands of stranded passengers as many had predicted. Additional flights by competitors, coupled with postponed travel, eased the impact of the Northwest shutdown. As red-tailed planes sat mothballed, union and airline leaders blamed each other for the breakdown.
As far as I know, we have an offer to Northwest management to resume talks whenever they're willing to come to the table.
The pilots are claiming all kinds of things, but the problem is that no one's contacted the Northwest negotiators.
The initial rhetoric offered an early indication the walkout would not be settled quickly. President Clinton didn't exercise his authority to force Northwest pilots back to work under the Railway Labor Act, but the White House did intervene within days of the walkout, summoning the two sides to the Washington, D.C. offices of Transportation Secretary Rodney Slater.
I emphasize to both parties the president's concern about the impact that this strike is having on the economy of specific regions of the country and upon the flying public. I ask both parties to get beyond whatever factors had led to the breakoff of negotiations and requested them to consider whether further negotiations would be productive.
A week later, Slater traveled to the Twin Cities with top Clinton aide Bruce Lindsay to help mediate negotiations. Lindsay stayed in town until Northwest and its pilots reached a tentative agreement. President Clinton announced the deal from outside the White House.
Northwest Airlines and its pilots have reached terms that form the basis of an agreement. The parties are now working on the specific time of getting back to work. The agreement, of course, will have to be approved, but I think this strike is over.
Leaders of the pilots' union quickly finalized the settlement. After a 19-day shutdown, Northwest Airlines began restoring service. Northwest told Wall Street events leading up to the walkout, the strike itself, and its aftermath cost more than $600 million from July through September. For the first 9 months of 1998, Northwest posted net losses of more than $100 million compared to net profits of nearly $500 million during the same period a year earlier. While dealing with angry workers and customers preoccupied Northwest for much of 1998, the airline did move ahead with plans for a partnership with Houston-based Continental Airlines. Northwest bought a 14% stake in Continental, giving the Minnesota airline controlling interest on major decisions at Continental, including mergers and acquisitions. The two airlines launched an extensive operating alliance, which critics charge will reduce competition and increase ticket prices. The Department of Justice is suing to block the partnership. In the area of competition, the pilot strike underscored just how dominant Northwest is in its hub markets, Detroit, Memphis, and Minneapolis-St. Paul. 1998 brought a significant increase in Twin Cities-based Sun Country Airlines' flight schedule, and the Metropolitan Airports Commission decided to build a new, much larger charter terminal at the Twin Cities Airport. Proponents of more competition hope a large, modern second terminal will encourage more airlines to serve the Twin Cities and lead to reduced airfares.
What do you want? When do you want it?
No!
What do you want?
Northwest CEO John Dasburg said his top priority for 1998 was to resolve contentious contract disputes with all of the airline's workers. However, the year ends with the airline's two largest unions, the Teamsters representing flight attendants and the machinists who represent most ground workers, still without new contracts. The flight attendants say, like the pilots, they'll shut down Northwest with a strike if their contract isn't resolved. The machinists voice the same threat. They're likely, however, to officially lose their most powerful group of workers next year. Northwest's mechanics and aircraft cleaners voted to switch from the IAM to the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association. AMFA, as it's called, is awaiting certification of the election, which the IAM is challenging. If AMFA becomes the mechanics and cleaners' new union, as is expected, dealing with it may be one of Northwest's biggest challenges of the new year. This is Mark Zadeklik, Minnesota Public Radio.
The Northwest Airlines strike was probably the biggest business-related news story of the year, but there were lots of other Minnesota businesses making headlines this past year, in part because of all the corporate mergers and acquisitions that occurred in 1998. Even the Minnesota Vikings changed hands. However, unlike similar takeovers in the 1980s, this year's mergers involving Minnesota companies were marked by a comparative lack of turmoil. Minnesota Public Radio's Bill Catlin reports.
In Minnesota, the financial services industry saw the greatest merger activity. Three companies announced deals totaling $45 billion. Norwest's merger with West Coast banking power Wells Fargo was one of the biggest transactions in the country. Insurer Conseco bought Greentree Financial. The St. Paul companies bought a competing insurer, USF&G of Maryland. And in the field of healthcare, Medtronic bought not one, but five companies in rapid succession. One big reason for the surge in mergers, the bulls on Wall Street. Many deals have been paid for with stock. A CEO sitting atop a rising share price has more buying power. Also, deregulation is putting a premium on size in the telecommunications, financial services, and utilities industries, and American Express Financial Advisors economist Dan Laufenberg says mergers are viewed as a way to help the bottom line.
Price increases are hard to come by. We're in a low inflation, some people would argue a deflation environment, so it's really difficult for corporations to raise prices, and they're faced with increasing costs. And so that means their profit margins are being squeezed. And so the only way that they can improve their profits is to get revenue growth, to get revenues to grow. One way to do that, if you can't do it on your own, is to acquire it.
Say no!
On a sunny September morning on the plaza outside the Federal Reserve Bank in downtown Minneapolis, activists and union members raised their voices in opposition to the biggest deal involving a Minnesota company, the $30 billion merger of Norwest and Wells Fargo. The protest stands out in part because there had been relatively little hue and cry over a merger that would cost Minneapolis the headquarters of one of the state's corporate old guard and the nation's seventh largest bank. To some, the muted response has been notable.
At this point, you haven't seen a lot of reaction. I mean, that's a big deal. That's a big deal.
Republican St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman has made business involvement a keystone of his effort to revitalize downtown St. Paul. He points out Norwest has worked hard to quell concerns, and the company promises little change in its approach to business or philanthropy in Minnesota. But Coleman says the departure of CEO Dick Kovacevich and the corporate headquarters to San Francisco is troubling. He says when you lose the CEO, the community loses clout.
You know, we have the Capital City Partnership in St. Paul that we formed. I think we're up to 47 CEOs now that are part of this organization. When you get the CEO on your side, being involved in the community, you get a lot done. Whether it's the return of the NHL, which could not have happened without them, whether it was the development of the St. Paul and the Mississippi Development Framework, long-term vision for this city's development, couldn't be done without them.
Several factors may help explain the lack of civic anxiety over mergers involving Minnesota firms. Among the biggest deals, Minnesota companies were more often the buyer and retained control of their own destiny. The takeovers themselves have been different.
In the late 1980s, phrases like corporate raider and hostile takeover hovered over bitter and protracted fights for control of a company. Top executives, who might have deep personal and philanthropic ties to the community, rarely kept their jobs if they lost a takeover battle, and their replacements might have little connection to the area. That scenario is far less prevalent now. Many mergers this past year were driven by what the acquired company is doing right, not what management was doing wrong, as in the 80s. For Minnesota, some of the mergers hold the promise of thousands of new jobs. Medtronic, which gobbled up five companies, expects to add 4,000 jobs, doubling its Minnesota employment. Medtronic CEO William George says the company has had good luck here.
Particularly on the innovation side, we found Minnesota a very good place from which to create new businesses through the process of innovation. So we like it as a place to expand and find it a good place.
Still, layoffs are a hallmark of mergers. The St. Paul companies and the new Wells Fargo have announced job cuts of between 2,000 and 3,000 each. Wells Fargo says it will retain and retrain as many as possible. According to the firm Challenger Gray & Christmas, which helps laid-off workers find jobs, merger-related job cuts through November are running at double last year's pace. CEO John Challenger says mergers and acquisitions are probably the greatest source of workplace stress because they threaten job cuts. But he says layoffs have become more routine.
That doesn't mean it's easy in the slightest for anyone. But back in 93, when the first real heavy downsizing hit, we saw people just shocked, never expected, in fact, that a layoff might occur. Today, everybody has been through it before, has a family member or a friend who's been through it. So it's less of a surprise today to people.
The good news for those who are laid off is record low unemployment. Dan Loffenberg of American Express Financial Advisors says he's seen research suggesting that many people laid off wind up with jobs that pay more, not less, than their old one.
The message is if you're going to lose your job, now's a good time to lose your job because you might be able to find a job that does as well or maybe even better than what you were getting before. And this, I think, reflects the fact that the job market is extremely tight.
Minnesota's unemployment rate for November is the lowest on record for the month and the 12th consecutive month of unemployment rates under 3%. The merger fervor is likely to continue. The powerful economic forces behind it, deregulation, lack of pricing power, and excess capacity, particularly in financial services, are not going away. Even a dramatic plunge in the stock market may result merely in a pause, changing only how deals are paid for. For Minnesota Public Radio, I'm Bill Catlin.
So there are a few of the big stories of 1998. A reminder, over the noon hour, we're going to focus on the biggest Minnesota news story of the year, the election of Jesse Ventura. That's coming up over the noon hour. To end this hour, we're going to remember now some of the other folks who made news this year.
Something I've always wanted ever since I was a child. I have no memory of ever not wanting to be in elected office. I very much respect it, and I cannot tell you what a tremendous honor it is to be allowed to be governor. And that's something I think we tend to lose sight of. It's a great honor to be there. And I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been hard, it's been difficult, but it's also been both challenging and rewarding. And I will always be forever grateful. There are very few people that can say they lived their dream. I did. And I'm very, very humbled by it and very grateful for it.
I have been asked by a lot of my close friends, you know, why Minneapolis? Well, it's very simple. That's where the team is. But also, I will tell you, I have followed football on all levels all of my life. And there are certain teams that have a character that somehow other teams just don't seem to develop. And what I call purple pride is a very real thing in this area and with this football team.
I've never been 14-1 in my career. I don't even think I went 14-1 in basketball.
So to be able to do it in the NFL and in this division that we're in such a tough division, it's just wonderful.
I really see the space station as a stepping stone in that in international cooperative effort of the future. I think if we can learn to do this in low Earth orbit, 200 miles above the Earth, and build a project of this magnitude and work together up there, that it'll carry over to bigger and better things.
I am running or thinking about running soon to announce this campaign because we'll talk about children. We will talk about education.
I have been saying everywhere I go that I'm representing the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, and that's all about universal health care coverage and jobs at decent wages and investment in public education and an investment in children and sustainable environment. And you know what? That's what most people believe in.
We're the United States, for crying out loud.
Either assimilate or hit the goddamn road. I'm saying again, I'm sorry.
To risk engagement with an idea is a very frightening thing, and that's what theater is. And people come and they want the theater to either substantiate their view of the world or to make them forget their view of the world, when in fact what theater is a forum whereby ideas are put forth to engender a dialogue about those ideas. The theater doesn't want to convince you, it wants to elicit, are your beliefs deep enough to disagree?
I still wonder why they applaud. I have no idea. I guess it just signals the start of the concert or the show or whatever people would like to call it. You know, okay. I think it's just the formal start. That's about it. And then you're supposed to be having a good time. I always have a good time when I do it. So, but as far as getting applause, actually, I have a very funny story on this. There's an older lady who had never really been to a concert, and after the intermission, when I came again for the second time after the rest of the orchestra, she turned to this young woman and said, "Now, why does this guy always arrive late?" So you see, it's different things to different people.
I think some days I'm sure about not playing. And then there'll be a couple day stretch where, you know, I'll be teased a little bit either about how good my body feels or how well I swing the bat, or I'll talk to a friend and they'll tell me I'm crazy to retire, and just enough to keep me confused long enough to keep putting the decision on hold.
You know, so many people ask us, why do you review the news? Why do you regurgitate all that bad news? Who needs that? What's the point? Well, the point is to remind ourselves of how lucky we are to have survived it each week.
This is a wonderful night. I'm a little excited, but anyway, wouldn't Hubert have been proud?
Thank you. Thank you.
That remembrance of some of the people who made news in 1998 was prepared by Minnesota Public Radio's Chris Roberts. This is Midday coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. A reminder once again, over the noon hour today, we're going to continue our review of 1998. Special focus over the noon hour on the biggest story of the year, maybe the biggest political story of the decade, the election of Jesse Ventura as governor of the state of Minnesota. That's over the noon hour.
I'm Ray Suarez. 1998 has been a busy year for news. It begins and ends with presidential scandal in the headlines, and in between we've seen global economic turmoil, a major antitrust suit against Microsoft, devastation wrought by El Nino. Join us for a look at 1998's top stories and how they'll set the scene for 1999 on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
As always, Mr. Suarez will be along at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Right now it's 12 noon. The weather forecast for this last day of 1998, sunny in the north, partial clearing in central Minnesota. Some flurries are forecast for southern Minnesota. Highs today 10 below in the northeast, 10 above in the south. News headlines are coming up next.
The music programming you hear every day on Minnesota Public Radio is made possible through listener contributions. If you haven't already made your tax-deductible 1998 contribution to NPR, call 1-800-227-2811 today. Thanks.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. We have some flurries at 6 degrees above. The wind chill is 8 below at KNRW-FM 91.1, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Should clear off in the Twin Cities this afternoon with a high around 10 above. Partly cloudy tonight with a low a little bit below zero. Cloudy tomorrow, 40% chance for light snow with a high around 10 degrees above zero.